There are two types of horns in the orchestra, and they could not be more different. I'm Colleen Phelps, and this is Classically Speaking. Today we'll get to hear from principal players of both types of horn in the Nashville Symphony. Leslie Norton, who leads the French horn section.
It's supposed to be easy.
And Roger Wiesmeyer, a Nashville native who returned home to join the orchestra as the lone English horn player.
It's just like a thrill a minute. It's like a roller coaster. It's like, what's going to happen next?
But ladies first. Since 1990, Nashville Symphony principal horn player Leslie Norton has been wowing audiences in Music City. This is significant. As recently as 2018, in the world's top orchestras, less than one-third of the principal players were women. These are the leaders in the orchestra, the most visible to the audience because they play the solos. And that number was even more pronounced for the horn section. Less than a fifth of hornists in these orchestras were women. The disparity doesn't seem to affect Nashville's sensibilities, though. Maybe because we've always known our horn section with Leslie Norton in the lead. Norton made a particular splash in 2017, stepping in front of the orchestra as the soloist for Brad Warner's Horn Concerto. The movements of this concerto paint fairly specific pictures, tintinnabulations, elegies, a tarantella. And Norton's performance received rave reviews, with her playing called clear and lucid. When I had the chance to talk to Leslie Norton, I actually let my college music appreciation students take the lead. They put together a list of questions that let them get to know Norton and also the French horn itself. How long is the horn if you unroll it?
They say 12 feet. I've never tried it, so I'm going to have to believe whoever they is.
That would be why it's rolled up.
That's
right.
There's
no way to do that. Why is your hand in the bell?
Well, because way back when, the valveless instrument, the right hand could go in different positions to find the awkward notes in between, the way we would cover or open or put in farther. We could sort of finesse notes that would not ordinarily be in that partial series. And you have to hold it somehow. Blows off the sound completely, and it brings the pitch, actually it shortens the tubing by half a step, which bumps it up, and it makes it a very buzzy, bright, almost percussive sound, very different than what you would ordinarily hear us do without that. Yeah, it's kind of a nasally, metallic color.
It's the equivalent of holding your nose and talking.
Absolutely.
Right? Okay. Why do you pick them up? When you're sitting in the section, sometimes they're up. Why did you pick it up when you picked it up?
Often composers will specifically ask for a bells up. And there's a lot of discussion about that. There's usually a fair amount of grumbling that goes on in the horn section when that happens. But I think aesthetically, it looks louder, if that makes sense. I guess it would also make it more rustic. I think composers like to think that it's actually louder. We like to think that it's more treacherous and dangerous for us to do that.
How do you mean dangerous?
Well, you know, you pick the thing up. You kind of have to twist your body to get around so that you're not putting the bell right into your neighbor's head, first of all. And so then there's a little bit of contorting that you're doing physically. And then to have it just in that awkward position, you know, the horn is kind of famous for not being the most accurate of instruments. So then you add one more issue to it, then the chances are something's going to go awry. So we're not always eager to play with bells up. Corigliano asked for bells up when he was here a few weeks ago when we played his first symphony, and I just asked, well, do you want it louder, or do you want it to look louder? And he said, I just want it louder. And so we agreed not to play bells up. Mahler does it often. He has bells up, and you have to admit, when you're in the audience and you see that, it looks great. And so you actually do think it is louder, and to some extent it's a little louder. So it has a multi-purpose.
People hear with their eyes.
That's right. The notes are so close together. Flinch once and you've missed it. Think about missing it and you've missed it. And really, the janitor can hear if you've had a hard night. You don't have to be a good musician to know that the horn player did well or didn't do well. So, yeah, I feel like we own that one.
Someone in my class who was a mom asked, how do you make sure there's not germs trapped in every nook and cranny of all those turning
tubes?
Oh,
there's germs in there. You know there are. I'm sorry. But we don't run around playing other people's instruments, so likewise, mouthpieces. I'm not about to play someone else's until I've cleaned it off, but, you know, it's just one of the... At least they're my germs. They're my germs, so I'm okay with it.
One of my teachers used to describe orchestral playing as a constant three-legged race. Can you talk about how you rely on each other in the orchestra outside of just covering notes?
I think we all know our strengths and weaknesses. Like I say, you know, I'm confessing to not being the greatest low player, and I think those who can do it well will really compensate for that. Or when the high stuff is in the middle of a heavy piece, and I can lay out some of the other things to make sure that I'm ready to take the ball on that. So there's a little give and take in that. And as well, in the way we don't all play every piece so that everyone has a chance at being successful on the heavy ones, and someone will carry the ball on another piece on the program. So yeah, we are constantly spelling each other that way.
Outside of the germs, tell me about your horn.
This is new. I got it 2 years ago from a horn maker who lives in Memphis. And so he brought them up for us to play, and I really, really liked it and been so happy with it since then. So yeah, it's new to me. It's called a Lucas horn. He named it after his son, Lucas.
Do you keep one horn, or do you keep more than one depending on the situation?
I'm one of those rare people where I play one horn. I have a descant horn that I will play on a few really high things, like a Mozart violin concerto, that kind of thing. I know other horn players, even in our section, who's got four or five that they maybe will play for different things. But yeah, I stick to one. I find like equipment change gets me I get a little confused, so I don't mess with it very much. Likewise, mouthpieces, I have one mouthpiece.
All right. And then you put a horn attached to it.
And it all changes.
Yeah. What's your advice for the young, like the best piece of general advice for a young horn player? Let's start with the horn player who's first starting.
Well, I think would be to get a nice buzzy start on that mouthpiece, and it's supposed to be easy. So if you're working really hard in your face, you're trying too hard. Work with the buzz and the air, so that it should be an easy thing.
What about the high schooler who's been playing for 6 years and thinks, I might want to do this. This might be my career path.
That advice would be count the cost. And if you really love it and you feel like you'll just die if you can't do anything else, go for it and count the cost.
Let's do as Norton suggests and count the cost of approaching this orchestral career. First, there's decades of lessons on your instrument, 3 or 4 hours of practice every day. While your friends go on beach vacations over the summer, you reserve time for even more study, sometimes a sleepaway program. Or you work to pay off some of your living expenses during the year. There's also the literal cost, summer festivals, lessons, tuition, plus a professional quality instrument. It's enough money to buy a house. Then when it's time to get a job, you're one of a few hundred applicants, hopefully one of the 100 invited to actually audition. You get 5 minutes or so to prove you can be one of 4 finalists, and then with maybe 20 minutes behind a screen playing for a committee, sometimes they don't choose anyone and start the whole process over. Once you get the job, you work evenings. You put precarious strain on your tendons, your muscles, and your hearing. It's tough, but it's also amazing. What do you want people in general who come to the symphony or who see you play? What's the one big, like, gosh, I wish everyone knew this about the horn?
The one thing I want them to know, that it is beautiful, versatile, and powerful and human.
Moving from the brass section to the woodwinds, after the break, we'll talk to English hornist Roger Wiesmeyer about his turn as the soloist in an iconic piece of orchestral repertoire. Imagine sitting on stage in an orchestra playing this whirlwind. Full brass section, tons of energy, but you're not playing a note. Then, when everything gets quiet, all on your own, it's your turn. This is the Nashville Symphony, and the English hornist is Roger Wiesmeyer. Roger's a Nashville native. He went to Hillsborough High School, took lessons at the Blair School of Music, then after college played oboe in Pittsburgh, San Francisco, and Honolulu's orchestras. But eventually, he did what few classical musicians are able to do. He got a job in his hometown. Taking over the English horn position was a big change. It's a relative to the oboe, which he had been playing, but it's bigger, and there are different solos to learn and prepare, like Dvorak's Ninth Symphony.
Let's talk about the solo.
Okay.
Because you just told me you've made your peace with it.
I have.
What do you mean by that?
Well, sitting in orchestra, playing auditions, it's really easy to decontextualize the music and have it become something that's first on the page instead of first in the listener's ear and heart. The way Dvorak wrote this melody, the climax of it is in essentially the weakest part of the instrument. The highest note, the forte, is on a high C, which is not a very strong note. You know, the low register of the English horn sounds fuller and beefier. The high register, not so much. So by the time you get to there and you've played, you know, 20, 25 seconds, which is a while, and then you're kind of having to give extra juice, and it's just kind of hard. And so having taken auditions and becoming kind of divorced from what really matters, you can think, oh my goodness, it's never forte enough. And before then, it's, you know, two measures previous, it's pianissimo and it's never quiet enough. And so this time I just thought, I'm just going to sing. I'm just going to make it sound good. And maybe it's forte enough, maybe it's not. It felt good. I enjoyed it. I hope it sounded good. People seem to like it. You never know sitting in the orchestra really what's coming across. I'm just going to go on faith. I might even listen to the broadcast. It felt that good.
A solo like the one in the Largo movement comes with all kinds of pressure. So how do you prepare yourself for that, either physically or mentally? Do you have any ritual you go through to prepare for that?
Yes. It's all about having the right read. And I can't speak for other people, but I don't want to play a new read in a situation like that. Because reeds take a while to kind of settle into their juju, their comfort zone. And so basically I store up reeds from the beginning of the season, knowing that this is going to happen. And then I'll just kind of, maybe the week before, I'll sort through them and I'll try the solo on various reeds to see how they feel, if they're in tune, if they have a nice dynamic range, if the sound is nice. And then, so it's just kind of a process of elimination. I went from having, I think I had 18 reeds that I narrowed it down to about 12. And then I narrowed it down to three, two of which I actually played in public. We had two rehearsals and I played one on each of those rehearsals. The reed I ended up playing didn't have quite as full a sound, but it was very comfortable to play. And comfort's a really important thing when you're sitting in an orchestra.
How many reeds do you have in rotation at a time, usually? Because you said 18.
Well, that was 18 that I stored up since September. So I'll probably have maybe two or three reeds a week.
And then how many do you go through in a season?
I might play 25 reeds, maybe.
What is
over like 44 weeks.
A 44-week season.
Yeah.
20-something reeds.
That sounds about right. Maybe more.
I'm thinking, what's that comparable to? I think point shoes.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly it.
How many times have you played this solo, do you think? Like, it's Dvorak 9 makes the orchestra's rotation.
Oh, we did it last season. We did it two seasons before that. We probably did it, I think we opened the season probably 7 or 8 times. I mean, like,
Nashville.
In Nashville.
What about before that?
Actually, I didn't play a whole lot of English horn before I moved here. I was mostly an oboist. Nashville turned me into an English hornist.
But what are your favorite moments of that symphony outside the English horn solo?
Oh, so much of it. I mean, I only play the second movement, so I just it's a little hard to enjoy the first movement just because I know that the solo is looming. Oh, I love the trio of the scherzo. It's just so happy and so sweet. I adore the last movement.
It kind of crashes into you, I feel like. The
last movement. Oh, yeah.
It's just one big musical explosion.
Yeah.
Obsess over the end of the second movement, where it's not complete phrases, and everything kind of hesitates, and then there's a string quartet, and then the orchestra just kind of warms itself in.
I do love that. And actually, that's after all of my work is done. So I do really love that. I can love that in a way that I can never really love the first movement.
So just think, every time you're listening to that and you feel... when the orchestra completes the phrase over and over and over again, that must be 10 times the feeling for the English horn player.
You caught it, exactly. One thing I love about the English horn solo is that from a technical standpoint, it gets easier each iteration of it. The first one, you know, it's a long blow, and you have lots of kind of dynamic roadmaps that, you know, it's good to at least be aware of. Then the second time, he truncates it quite a bit. He goes up to the high C, but it's, you know, you don't have to play a long time before the high C. And then the last time, he doesn't even go up to the high C, and it's just like this kind of remembrance of the beautiful solo. And I always just kind of try and pace it emotionally, just really, I really like save my most beautiful tone for the last one.
Dvorak wrote about wide open spaces in the program notes for the first few performances of the Ninth Symphony. He had been to Iowa, like you said, and he had marveled at that openness, because even his, you know, natural, untouched world in Europe was not prairie. You know, it was just, so there was this can't see the end of the sky, you know, kind of vastness for him. Does it feel almost ironic to perform that sound here?
I wouldn't say ironic. It takes maybe a little bit of mental gymnastics to get back to there. I might not immediately feel the open spaces as I'm conceiving of playing it, but then you hear the first few chords of the second movement, and it just captures this mood, and it makes it very easy.
I never really read that he placed it at any particular moment, but that's exactly where I pictured it too. Those first few chords where it just sort of settles you for everything. That's when I feel that vastness.
Yeah.
Students don't generally start on English horn, or even its relative, the oboe. The reeds are a lot to deal with, and the instrument is expensive as a starter instrument. You're hearing Wiesmeyer on oboe now, though, and he freely admits the difficulties involved in playing the instrument.
What would you say to the young, very young, beginning classical musician, the person who's even playing the flute or clarinet and looking at that oboe in the eighth grade band and thinking, what's that like?
The thing about oboe is that the thing that makes the noise, the reed, the front edge of the reed is less than 1/100 of a millimeter thick. And literally, I can be on stage and I can sense that the weather is changing outside because it's just that sensitive. It can make you crazy. I mean, if you really want to do it, go for it. But if you're a parent out there, don't just like hand your kid an oboe and say, here, play this. You know, when I was in San Francisco, I was fortunate that I got to sit next to one of the world's great oboe players for a couple seasons. And I could just like watch him play the oboe and see that, yeah, he's a person like I am and he's doing it and I can pay attention and I can do it too.
And then what about the aspiring orchestral player, the person who's looking at the audition circuit and thinking, I'm going to get in there?
It's really hard. You have to really, really love it. And you have to sacrifice. The word sacrifice comes from two Latin words, which means to make holy.
Count the cost. Know the sacrifice. Advice from two veteran orchestral players who know the value of this commitment.
I mean, we've gotten to the point where everybody can play all the notes in tune all the time. So you have to bring something to it, something deep and caring and full of love.
Classically Speaking is a production of Nashville Public Radio's 91 Classical. The episode was edited by Anita Bug and engineered by Carl Peterson. I'm Colleen Phelps. The music was the Nashville Symphony's performance of Brad Warner's Horn Concerto, released in 2018 by Naxos, Richard Strauss's Serenade, Frank Martin's Concerto for Seven Winds, John Corigliano's Symphony No. 1, and Dvorak's Ninth Symphony in Concert, as well as Heroic Dance by Henry Cowell, performed by the California Parallel Ensemble. Make sure to subscribe to this podcast so you don't miss a beat. Rate us, review us, and tell a friend to check out your backstage pass to Nashville's classical music. Classically Speaking.